Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Mr. Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery, TROSA, and Your Health.
You know, Christy, the importance of substance abuse recovery and successful programs that are really transformative is such an important issue across the North Carolina and nationally. I'm so excited to have this conversation today with Mr. McDonald.
I am too. A remarkable program. I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about shingles and its relationship with stroke.
About the types of routines people do before they go to sleep, and does it matter what happens earlier in the day?
About a link between heavy alcohol and tobacco and drug use and mental illness.
About concussion history associated with the risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Interesting. And finally, about high testosterone levels, meaning weakened immune responses to flu shots and other immunizations.
So a lot of research right now, Christy.
Okay.
Let's jump right
fast
in there. We're going to talk initially about this first article about shingles, which everyone knows, herpes zoster virus. And if you've had it, does that increase your risk of stroke? And does that maybe change how you think about the shingles vaccination?
Yeah. So there's been previous studies showing that shingles rash was linked somehow with stroke within a year of the attack. And this is further research done in Britain looking at more than 105,000 people who had shingles and more than 213,000 people who did not have shingles, and looking at then what happened in their risk of stroke.
And this was published in the journal Neurology, and they found that for people who were under less than age 40, they were 74% more likely to have a stroke if they had shingles, even after accounting for other things that cause strokes like smoking, high cholesterol, or how heavy you were.
And there was also a link with patients under 40 being 2.4 more times more likely to have a warning stroke if they had shingles.
Is that like a TIA
or one of those mini strokes. and 50% more likely to have a heart attack. So some sort of link between these events in the circulating system of your body, your heart, and strokes with having shingles.
You know, this is important research because it suggests there's an inflammatory process happening when people have a reactivation of the latent chickenpox virus that now becomes the herpes virus and the shingles. And I think it gives more importance to having the vaccination that prevents the shingles.
Well, it's hard to know the chicken or the egg. Maybe there's something else going in the body that then makes your immune system more likely to reactivate that shingles. So I don't know that we can draw total conclusions, but I think we want to try to prevent shingles. But also, that should be a warning sign for us to then look for other risk factors for stroke and heart attacks and try to make sure people are making healthy choices. And
you know, Christy, the chicken is the chicken pox and the egg is where the vaccination comes
from.
I don't know, chicken or egg, I'll take the egg.
All right.
Speaking of things to take, let's talk about our next research that matters about sleep and the routines that one does before or after sleep, an article that was in the Journal of Gerontology.
Okay. So the first part of the study makes some sense to me, that young adults who went to work, so they looked at all these people and their lifestyle, what time they ate dinner, what their routines were like, and their sleep quality, and found that the young adults who went to work and ate dinner around the same time every day typically slept better and woke up fewer times in the night than people who had a more erratic routine.
You mean, so if I have my dinner one night at 5:30 and then the next night at 9:30 at night, and I keep altering when I have my meal, I might sleep more poorly if I'm between the ages of 18 and 30, which I'm not.
And then they found, yes, that's true, according to this. And then they found, and this is a small study, mind you, that for older people, they slept better and had fewer awakenings at night if they were less consistent with their daytime routine.
What?
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, this is a little bit. Sometimes we see some research that when we first are looking at it, we go, this is going to be research that matters. And then we think it's a little mishugany for a little Yiddish word here, meaning that it's a little crazy here, because why would it just change that way? And then we looked and saw that there are 50 subjects in both groups. They studied this for 2 weeks. It's interesting. I find this very interesting, the activities that one does, to what extent being on a routine really helps your sleep versus not a routine, but I don't think we can draw conclusions yet.
No, we do recommend that people have a routine nighttime pattern, that you go to bed at the same time, that you sort of treat your bed in the same way every night and try to wake up at the same time. Those routines are recommended and established that have an impact, but this is – I'm not sure what to draw from.
Well, this next research that matters, I think we can know what to draw from. And I guess, Christy and I would want to know what you as our listeners think about what we need to do about this. But this is about substance use in those with severe mental illness. And it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Journal of Psychiatry.
And so the study analyzed smoking, drinking, and drug use in nearly 20,000 people. And that included almost half of them were psychiatric patients who had significant mental illness with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or something called schizoaffective disorder, which is where people can have some hallucinations or delusions or mood disorders like depression as a part of their mental illness.
And things that will probably blow your socks away, it certainly did mine, is that 75% of this sample population with mental illness were regular smokers. 50% of this group with psychotic disorders used marijuana regularly, and 30% of these used and did binge drinking of alcohol.
And when they compared this to the general population, those rates were much lower. And so, you know, we don't understand all of the why, but one of the things that I thought was interesting is that in a lot of these substance abuse, even inpatient facilities, they let people continue to smoke and do some of those things, thinking, well, it's one step at a time. But in fact, we're probably not helping people very much if we're sort of promoting or allowing people to continue to hurt themselves in relation to their mental illness.
Yeah, I think every family in America has someone or knows of someone certainly that suffers from pretty profound mental illness. And I think it's all up to all of us as individuals and as society to intervene and recognize it's going to take more than Band-Aids. It's going to take more than just you and I, Christy, and our colleagues. Mm-hmm. It requires a societal approach.
Okay, let's do our next research that matters. And this is about some link between having a concussion and having plaques in your brain that are related to Alzheimer's.
This was also in the journal Neurology. And basically what they found is that there were higher rates of Alzheimer's in those who had had a concussion history than among those who had not had a concussion history, and they found some changes in the brain scans of some of these patients. Well, boy, what can you do about this if you've had a concussion? I don't know, but it certainly, I think, starts to show the impact of brain trauma on things like Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I think the fact that there was a difference in the plaques, which is linked with Alzheimer's, it just highlights how complex all of this is with the head trauma. They may not have gone on to have Alzheimer's disease, but there is that intermediate marker which makes us question. So, I mean, I think we need to protect our heads and try to do primary prevention with helmets and being careful with ourselves and our decision-making.
And if you had a concussion, take the time to recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of time, our last research that matters today is about the testosterone and the link between a higher testosterone level and a lowered immune system as a response to vaccination with influenza.
So a little background is that what scientists already had figured out is that there's some difference between women and men in how people respond to the flu influenza vaccine, in that women tend to generate higher immunity than men. And so this was a study where they looked directly at the testosterone levels in just the men and separated them into groups of low testosterone and high testosterone, and found, in fact, that people with high testosterone had lower antibody levels after getting the influenza vaccine. And so they weren't responding as well if they had higher testosterone.
And they took this to another level where they then linked this to actual changes in genetic material so that the men who had the high testosterone level had different levels of expression of certain genes and they kept these genes from turning on, which responded to less response of their immune system, which really raises an interesting question, which is people who are taking higher levels of things like testosterone in the belief that it may be improving their health, we begin to see some evidence perhaps that ultimately this could be actually damaging their health. This is preliminary research, but it's important, and we wanted to bring it to you.
I completely agree. Well, that will wrap up the research that matters. We've talked about high testosterone and some weakened immune system.
Concussions and Alzheimer's.
About alcohol, tobacco, and drug use, much higher in severely mentally ill patients.
About daily routines, and maybe you can send us some of your only daily routines to help out with sleep.
And about shingles may increase your risk for stroke and heart attack.
We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Mr. Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Dr. Page could not be with us for this section of the interview, but we're fortunate to have Dr. Caroline Roberts, one of our great resident physicians at the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, with us for the interview. And today on Conversations, we're talking with Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery, TROSA, and your health.
I'm excited to be here today. I've heard about TROSA for quite a while, and I'm excited to meet you, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you very much, Caroline and Adam. I'm excited to be here. I really appreciate you letting me come and be on your show.
Well, we're very excited, and let's just dive right in by learning a little bit more about you and your story. I think it seems like everyone who knows in this region of TROSA speaks of Mr. McDonald and Kevin. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be involved.
Well, I didn't go to Harvard. I didn't go to Yale. My family was military. My dad was a military officer, pilot, a highly decorated World War II bomber pilot. I grew up on military bases, and we're in Germany. And when I was 13, I started drinking. And then we came to California. Went to high school there, continued the drinking, really felt out of place on the outside looking in. And it went from there to drugs, you know, born to be a hippie, still didn't fit, and into heroin addiction, to hardcore crime, and which culminated in 1979, being arrested for 2 armed robberies, 2 gun allegations, about 100 possessions of dangerous drugs, prescriptions from pharmacies. And then I moved, you know, was lucky enough. At that point, I was supposed to do 20 years in prison, was the deal they were giving me. And a lawyer found a Supreme Court reversal that I fell under. The 2 months before it was reversed, I was able to go to a program in San Francisco called the Lancy Street Foundation.
So tell us a little bit more about, this seems like there was a pivotal time, not necessarily when you had a choice of going there or serving a long prison sentence, but something changed in you. What changed, and how did that change take place and make you think, I'm going to dedicate my life to taking care and helping people, perhaps like yourself, who need another chance?
When I went to Delancey Street, I was really scared. You know, I'd seen violence before, and people think, well, you're afraid there. Well, I was. But going to treatment was really scary to me because it was about emotions and feelings, and I didn't let those out. All I knew was anger and hate. And so going into that program and seeing people that wanted to care about me, and I had nothing. And so I'll give you an example. One person every morning said hello, and of course I didn't answer him back. But it felt so good inside of me that somebody saying, good morning, hello, how are you, that eventually I said, good morning. And I do that to every resident in Trosa when I pass them now from that experience. And so I started changing, and change is hard. It's scary to be, you know, changed into somebody else because you've always had, you know, an image that you live with and who you are. And when you break that down, it's scary, and you have to be part of that process, the lead part of that process. And so that started helping me change. And then role models, people who I thought were just like me or similar to me, and they were some dope fiend. They didn't seem like one now. And so that was really encouraging to me. And then I had a mentor. And it turned out I had a lot of mentors, but in Delance Street, the co-president's name is Dr. Mimi Sobert. And her partner was a guy named John Maha. He started drinking. He was the founder. And she and the board put him out. And they couldn't get help for him. And that was such a monumental thing that somebody would do the right thing. Because on the streets, you know, nothing is right. Everything is dishonest. And that's what you look at when you go into a program. What, you know, who's doing this and who's doing that and where can you find the drugs? You know, because nothing's for real. And so that lady was my role model, which in a sense is very different from a guy running in the streets pretty hard to have a woman as your role model. But that's what happened.
So explain to our listeners the quick, you know, 2-minute soundbite about what TROSA is.
Hi, Caroline. TROSA is a 2-year residential program for men and women, some as an alternative to incarceration, others who just are tired and want to start their lives over again. And the reason it's 2 years is it takes time to change. And what we have is a holistic program where men and women come there, and let's put it into 3, 4, 5 areas. One is a work ethic. 2 is medical care. 3 is psychiatric scare. 4 is empowerment. And 5 is education. So you're living in this residential setting, learning just different job skills, and starting to, you know, take care of your medical health. Looking into, I have psychiatric problems, you know, and dealing with that. And then education is really important. People think they're stupid. I did. I didn't used to talk when I went into that program because I thought I was so stupid. And so once you find out and you start opening, you start, you know, trying. And big thing is hope in this program. You know, all of a sudden you have no hope, and then maybe along the way there's some hope. Well, in the program, the men and women are learning different trades, and we have, you know, a variety. And then at the same time, the community heals. And so without the men and women there helping each other, that's one of the major portions of the program there, TROSA. There's no charge to come in. We're not state-funded, blah, blah, blah. We do have a little state funding. But the people at Fuqua and Keenan Flagler say we're social entrepreneurs. I can't spell entrepreneur because I just barely got out of high school. But that's where we're bringing in about 70% of our income ourselves.
So for our listeners, they should understand we're speaking with Kevin McDonald, president and founder of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery. And I guess they should know that starting with a budget of $18,000 funds to raise, you now have a budget of over $13 million a year. I think that qualifies as social entrepreneurs.
Thank you.
So where does the money come from? And, you know, how do you – where do you raise it?
All right. Let's look at our moving company. I started with one truck. I knew how to drive trucks. I used to go around to the Kiwanis and different organizations. You might call them gangs. I call them social clubs. But and I'd say, hey, let me do an estimate. But before that, I had to get licensed by a specific licensing group in North Carolina for movers. And then we started one job at a time. And our method of marketing and advertisement was a customer saying they did a good job. And so we'd get another customer. Today we do 5,000 moves a year. And the budget for that is, I'm not the budget, but what we bring is about 5 point something million from moving. Lawn care, same thing. We probably do a moving about a million now. And so, and then we have a small thrift store that we just changed locations from downtown Durham to another location on East Gear. And that brings in income.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be continue talking with our guest, Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Carolyn Roberts. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Caroline Roberts. We've been talking with Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, about substance abuse recovery, TROSA, and Jura Health. Previously in our segment, we were talking to Mr. McDonald about what TROSA is and kind of what got you to the point where you decided to found an organization like that. I'm curious, what kind of requirements does it take for a person to get into TROSA? Do you accept only people with addiction problems or also people with psychiatric comorbidities as well?
Caroline, this is the method of getting into TROSA and who can come. First, number one, a person has to want to be there. That's the main criteria. And then it gets into, you know, if you have mental health issues and substance abuse issues, that's great. But at what degree that we can deal with the mental health issues? So certain types of mental health issues, we can't accept people. And the same with certain type of criminal offenses like rape, arson, child molestation, things like that. And so that's about it. And then through the interview, a person can be in jail and you want to be there and then get accepted and then be probated if the judge sees fit. And other people are MBAs, nurses, etc. So it really crosses the line as far as who comes into TROSA. Right now we have approximately 450 residents in TROSA.
So tell us about what a typical day looks like for someone who's in TROSA, and what would people be surprised? What would our listeners be surprised? Because I suspect they don't necessarily think of people in TROSA out cutting lawns, moving furniture, working behind the counter in thrift stores.
Yeah, I think that the typical day goes by different phases. But let's say when somebody first gets there, you know, they'll be part of what we call a squad, believe it or not, because certain types of verbiage we use. And so we're trying to instill an esprit de corps in them to start out. So we're starting to put them together. They get up in the morning. They go to breakfast. After breakfast, the new person will help clean up the dishes. Then they'll go to what we call a morning meeting. And basically, that's when they get together and somebody will get up and speak about a subject. They might sing a song. It's just a multitude of things that might happen. Then people go to their job assignments. And so here you have people coming off the street and, you know, they're still bouncing off the wall. So in those first 30 days, we're taking care of them, making sure that each one teach one. The guy that came in the day before is helping the next person who came in the day after him. Here's the broom closet. Here's a broom. Sweep this floor. And then after that, they're assigned to a job. We want to put people into job training where they can succeed. And I'll show you the difference real quick. You go on a moving job. By the end of the day, you finish that job. You see what you've accomplished, and you feel good. Hey, I was part of that. You put a person in a sales job, calling different corporations asking for product donations, water, clothing, etc. Well, a lot of people can't do that. There's a lot of rejection, and that's too much. So putting people in jobs, you can see that. Then at night, we have different types of therapies, different types of educational type. If a person's going for their GED or they're going to college, etc. And we are using evidence-based therapy, RBT, DBT, women in recovery. And then for people with post-traumatic stress, there's a military therapy called Seeking Safety. So we're combining that with a therapeutic community type therapy, which is the men and women helping each other and small therapeutic encounters that we have. And that together makes a difference. But again, the community heals. And that's what's so important of a therapeutic community.
So your latest annual report has shown that 95% of your recent graduates are still employed, and 85% of them have not relapsed in their addiction after 1 year of completing the program. What is this success? What do you think this is attributed to?
Well, one of the things that in Delancey Street, I brought certain things from Delancey Street to start TROSA. But one of the things that I didn't see was aftercare. And so what we've set up is a pretty strong aftercare department where from at 18 months teaching people how to do resumes so to get jobs, et cetera, how to present yourself, to giving that support mechanism form to get jobs, paying tens of thousands of dollars to get their licenses back and things like that, the fines, et cetera. And then if they don't get their license back, if they don't have a car, obviously, who's going to hire them? Well, we'll drive them within a 26-mile radius to work every day for up to a year for just gas money once they're graduated. And then the other thing is donated cars. We'll give a resident who can drive a donated car. Obviously, in the recession or whatever we're in now, we're about 14 cars behind, but that's very helpful. Then we have an apartments that people can stay into for after a year after graduating, so it's low-cost housing. So again, that aftercare, the housing, if they go into their own housing, we give them free furniture. Anything to help them, you know, not just the program ends and you're out on your own. You have to help, and they have to be formed into the continuation of the community they've been in. And that's what makes it so successful, I think.
This is amazing. We're speaking with Kevin McDonald, founder and president of TROSA, and talking about substance abuse recovery. And really, really quite amazing. You mentioned this work ethic and the medical and the psychological and the empowerment and the education, but you really are talking about community. You're talking about a community. And I guess the thing that's so endearing to me is this feeling that, well, after a year or two, or after a 28-day inpatient stay in the hospital, we send people out to wherever they were, and they're back being individuals, perhaps without that community. But you've managed to continue to create the community.
Absolutely. We work really hard at that because I think if you stay and the water is keep still, you draw mosquitoes. And if we don't keep evolving and using the evidence-based therapy, you know, what's the research on aftercare? What's the research on this or that? And so I'm a dinosaur, but every day I drive to work, I don't see any other dinosaurs. So I feel that, hey, I better be part of this evolution or TROSA or they'll get rid of me. But it's something I really deeply believe in.
So TROSA has gone through many, many changes since its implication in 1994. What are your goals for the next 10 years for TROSA?
Great question. Well, there's some dinosaurs that have been with TROSA since the start. Some who are all who are staff members, some who've gone through the program have gone through Delancey Street. And 60% of our staff are graduates of TROSA. And so basically, how do you get rid of me? And so my board has an ad hoc committee on just, you know, replacing me, but also replacing these key individuals so there won't be an implosion. And so that's the last 4 years is just been going on and on. And then the other part of it is when you have one style of management, you know, you have to adjust. And it's just not the people coming in, it's me. Because while I'm there adjusting to, you know, change, and I have to be that person that has to be most flexible. The other thing is, where is the future? There's something called pay for performance that's been around the United States. And basically what that means is, let's say those rates of recidivism, the state might have a certain rate and we might beat it. So basically we're looking at, hey, don't pay us now. We're going to set a certain metric and say, hey, here is what you have. We'll beat that by 10%, 15%. You don't pay us now, but in 2, 4, 6 years, you pay for it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Carolyn Roberts. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a little bit of time talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you'd like to have a question or a concern that you want us to address on an upcoming show, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to tell us our very first House Call today. Erica?
I am 77 years old and have MS. I recently developed a cough and the doctor said I have pneumonia. Although I am not coughing yellow or green stuff, I was placed on antibiotics. How do you know that this is not a bacterial infection?
Well, that has a lot of questions in it, and is complicated most certainly by having MS, which sometimes can make your muscles, as you know, not work as well and could make it hard to clear an infection.
You know, I don't think we don't know. There's a lot of negatives in there, but we don't know that it's not a bacterial infection, certainly without the fever and the yellow and green stuff. But we certainly can worry because diseases like MS can also lower your immune system's mm-hmm. ability to fight off infections. You may not be able to swallow as well, and so you could be at risk for what's called aspiration pneumonia, the pneumonia where you kind of swallow your own secretions.
And it sounds like your doctor was thinking it might be some sort of bacteria involved because it sounds like the doctor gave some antibiotics. So that's probably what the doctor was thinking, that maybe there is some bacterial pneumonia involved.
Yeah, you know, it's probably a good conversation for you to have with your doctor about whether or not you should take those antibiotics, when you should take them, how long it is to wait, whether you need to have an x-ray, whether you need blood work. These are all individual questions you need to have with your doctor. We can't give any really specific advice for you, but encourage you to talk with your doctor.
Let's take our very next house call. Erica?
At my last annual checkup, I weighed 268 pounds. My doctor said I needed to lose weight, and I got down to 220 pounds in about 5 months. I'm sad and discouraged to see an increase in my weight gain. What type of advice do you have for me?
Wow. Well, first of all, congratulations. That is significant weight loss, and you should feel really proud of yourself for having accomplished that. And it sounds like, you know, you have a good relationship with your doctor, and somehow that motivated you. But really, that's work that you had to do for yourself, and you've done it. I think having some I'm not sure how much weight you've gained back, but the fact that you've done it so recently, I think, helps you know that there is a way, that whatever you did to lose that weight was effective. And so I would say, you know, feel proud, but
get
back on the horse.
Go get them. Get back on that horse. Yeah, you know, for those who've never been able to lose that weight, they're probably looking at you and saying you're a success story. You're a motivation and inspiration. We know that quitting smoking takes 3, 4, 5 attempts to quit for good. We know that losing weight may take 3, 4, 5 attempts of losing weight, perhaps regaining it. We don't want you to regain it. We'd like you to kind of keep moving down. But boy, you know that strategy of how to lose weight. Now the next step's going to be, how do you keep it off? That's a great question. Talk with your doctor. Talk with the nutritionist. And then write us again.
Yeah, keep us posted on how it's going. But definitely stay at it. Let's take our next house call. Erica.
My family recently went on vacation, and my 25-year-old brother woke up one morning with a severe headache and vomiting that continued throughout the day. Despite Tylenol and Robitussin, he kept vomiting. Could this be the flu? Also, when should we take someone to the emergency room?
Well, you know, we're still right in the middle of a really pretty bad influenza season. And so these questions come at a really important time. And, you know, we really need to address all these questions. What's about the very first question about could it be the flu? What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think typically with influenza, we would hear some element of cough or body aches or other respiratory symptoms. And so with just vomiting and a headache, that makes me more worried that it's either a different kind of virus or something else going on.
Yeah, you know, viruses are notorious during this time of year, and there are types of viruses that can cause meningitis, and as well as the influenza virus that can cause some of these symptoms if you had body aches and you didn't mention a fever or sore throat. Also, we'd want to know, did you have a flu shot? Because maybe if you had flu shots, maybe if you get the flu, it may not be as severe, so it could be a more minor case. Should you go to the emergency room? Boy, that's a tough question. You know, I'm generally not a big fan of going to the emergency room if you're still able to keep food down and the vomiting goes away after 12 to 24 hours. What do you think,
yeah,
Christy?
I think the most important thing with vomiting to guide you is you got to stay hydrated. So even if you don't eat for a few days, that's fine as long as you can keep down little sips of fluids. And so if you can get some Gatorade or some other type of fluid and just take a little sip every few minutes just to keep that in you as you're losing it, then hopefully that can keep you out of needing to go to the emergency department. But if you can't hold anything down for an extended period of time, even liquids, then you might need some IV fluids.
Just one sip. That's all it takes. But you do have to keep it down because we do know that a lot of these young adults are the ones that have actually had the severe flu too.
Mm-hmm.
So hope you're getting better. Erica, what's our very last house call?
Is there anything we can do to lower our health risk when we are exposed to really cold temperatures?
Boy, what a good question when the entire country was exposed to really cold temperatures. Where were you, Christy, when that cold temperature came about?
It was cold. I was home. I was here.
You're in North Carolina?
I was in North Carolina.
I was in Utah.
Oh.
I was out on the ski slopes. It was pretty cold out there.
Oh, did you have some hand warmers?
I had hand warmers and I had foot warmers and I had layers so that the layers, you know, really help keep you warm when you have three or four layers, one on another, that helps protect you against the wind. The wind is what sometimes is so cold.
Yeah, I think there are some elements of just thinking about common sense. If you have to be outside when it's really cold, to protect your eyes and try to protect from windburn. To think about the sun in terms of sometimes wearing sunscreen.
That's right. We had to wear sunscreen on the slopes and lip balm. Also, prevent getting wet. When you get wet in the cold, then you really can have a problem. So if you get exposed to wet, you need to get those wet clothes off. When you're indoors in really cold temperatures because you're trying to stay warm, you got to be really careful, too, of the kerosene and the space heaters and ensuring that you don't get exposed to carbon monoxide or accidental fires.
And don't forget, even when you're cold, you're burning energy. And so you want to stay hydrated, drink lots of fluids, and make good choices, avoid alcohol and smoke and those kinds of things to stay healthy.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. And you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook. Get our health app by searching one word at the App Store for Your Health for a free download.
We'd like to thank UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Mr. Kevin McDonald. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.